Reginald Howard has joined us here on Sports Byline. We're talking about the Negro Leagues, a part of baseball, and we'll talk a little bit later on about Jackie Robinson and his thoughts about why African Americans are not playing baseball as much as they used to. Let me ask you about the owner of the Clowns, Sid Pollack. All of those guys that owned those teams were numbers guys, right?
Yeah, but not Sid Pollack.
What was he then?
He's a promoter.
Okay.
Promoter a lot of different things. He was involved in promoting basketball as well as baseball.
Yeah. But when I say numbers guys, can you explain to everybody what I'm referring to when it comes to the other owners?
Well, they call it the lottery of the day. But it was what blacks called it, policy, P-O-L-I-C-Y. And most of the owners were policy operators. Probably the most prodigious one, as far as I'm concerned, was Gus Greenlee, who owned the Pittsburgh Crawfords. And Gus was so efficient at what he did. In 1931, during the Harlem Depression, Gus Greenlee built a brand new ballpark when people weren't working. Gus Greenlee was the first promoter of a championship boxing match by a black promoter. It was Al Gaynor and Don Henry Lewis. It was held outside at Gus Greenlee Field. So a lot of people don't even know he exists. He had the Pittsburgh Crawfords when they had the 32-35 Crawfords, what I equate with the 27-29 Yankees. The Yankees had five Hall of Famers, and the Crawfords had five Hall of Famers, too. Tony Nazario at second, and Oscar Charleston was at first. Cool Baba Bell was at center, Josh Gibson was catching, and Leroy Sacho Page was heading their pitching staff. That was the top five Hall of Famers.
Tell me about the last three that you named, because most people, if they know anything about the Negro Leagues, know those last three names about, Cool Papa Bell and the others. Tell me about them. What was fact and what was fiction about them?
I don't know. I try to stay away from all that fiction stuff. I can't stay away. I don't even like to even discuss it. But a lot I got from Jimmy Crutchfield. I don't know if you know. Jimmy was on that same team. He lived in the same building my brother lived in Chicago. And every time I go to Chicago, I would just I'd get with him and spend as much time as I possibly could. Jimmy, and the one thing that was so outstanding about Bell, and I really admire him for this, I've never heard anybody echo a disparaging word about him. A first-class gentleman, you know, all the way around. And I really admire that so much.
When it came to Satchel Paige, the great line is that he was so fast that he could turn out the light and he could get in bed.
That's foolishness. I don't even like to discuss that kind of stuff. No, I'm serious. That's a waste of time. When we could do something meaningful that other people can, we can give out meaningful information and not throw out that kind of garbage.
Well, when you say meaningful, tell me a little bit what's meaningful to you as somebody that played in the Negro Leagues.
Well, let's take it from a social standpoint of view. Let's take Satchel Paige. And this thing I loved about Satchel, a lot of people don't know this. I explained to you about Negro League games being played 3 days a week, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, okay? Let's say Satchel pitches Saturday at Moorman Park in Kansas City against the Memphis Red Sox. And he pitches a good game. All right, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the fourth day, is his turn again. But they're playing somebody in Beloit, Wisconsin. You know, a little bit they're barnstorming now, just a little bit ahead of a high school team. So why would they use it? They wouldn't use a good pitcher on that day. However, 3 weeks ahead of time, a team in Minot, North Dakota, or in Rochester, Minnesota, said, hey, we want to hire Satchel for that day. I call him a hired gun. And Satchel would go there and pitch for that team on that Wednesday. But now he would pitch there, but then he'd come back Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. They played in Memphis, ballpark full, and Satchel Paige is pitching. He did a lot of that. He did a lot of leaving the club that he was with and going pitch outside of the Negro League. And that's why he was one of the highest paid players in baseball.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, about the salaries. How much did players generally get? And somebody like a Satchel Paige or others that were the stars, how much would they make? What would be a top salary for them?
I would say, and I'm talking out of school because it wasn't it got down to me or whatever. But I would say Satchel would have probably made maybe $1,000 a month, but which was good money in the late 30s, early 40s.
And how about the typical player in the Negro League?
I said he would be $500 a month. I'd say $500 a month.
You mentioned
I was doing some background stuff, and I just picked up a copy of Willie Mays' first contract, and it was interesting, the amount of money was on there. I won't tell you, but it was interesting. With T.H. Hayes, who was the owner of the Birmingham Black Barons, and he was the field director here in Memphis.
When you talk about the teams that were in the Negro Leagues at that time, what were the standout teams? The Black Barons, I know, were one. The Clowns were another one. The Kansas City Monarchs.
Kansas City Monarchs. And Newark had a heck of a team. It was 46 when they had Dobie. I think they had Dobie and Wells, Willie Wells, and Ray Dandridge, and Monty Irvin, Bob Harvey. Oh, they had a heck of a ball club over there. Pitchers like Leon Day, Max Manning, a young Don Newcomb, like 19 or 20 years old, throwing the ball through a brick wall. They had a heck of a ball club in that era. B.S. Mackey was still there. And then, Mackey was getting old. Mackey was a catcher and manager. But the other catcher there, Leon Ruffing, yeah. They had a heck of a ball club that year. They beat the Monarchs that year in the World Series.
Let's talk a little bit more about the barnstorming, because we have seen movies, which I don't, they're Hollywood productions. But what was it like when you were on a barnstorming team, traveling the country where, as I said, there was not a lot of social open-mindedness at that time, and also playing games? I know in talking to some of the Harlem Globetrotters in the early years, they told me about the challenges that they had and what the atmosphere and what the playing circumstances were. What was it for the Negro Leagues?
I'm glad you brought up that, because there's so many. The Negro Leagues media is like a big wheel, and the players were a part of the spokes, but there are other part of the spokes that are part of that wheel, like the bus drivers. We had some guys that they knew where to go, how to go, and this is before Eisenhower's highway program. You go right through your cities and past the fire department, past the police stations, and all that. But these guys knew how to keep us on the right areas. Some parts of the country, they just didn't care for people of color, period. Other times, other areas of the country, there, because of religious reasons, there were people that didn't drive automobiles. But you're only one of these two-lane highways. You might have a guy on a horse and a wagon, and you can't get around it for 5 miles, 5 or 6 miles. So it has an effect on you. And also, they kept the buses in good condition some kind of way to get us from point A to point B. And they were just meaningful, as the ball players were. And I'm sure their descendants think as much of their contribution to the Negro League as the players themselves.
You had a guy who was a preacher, a Caribbean preacher, Don Wilson.
I mentioned Don Wilson?
Yep.
He wasn't a preacher. He was a player. He was from Kingston, Jamaica.
Yeah, Kingston, Jamaica. But
Kingston, Jamaica, yeah. Yeah. He was tickling. I think I probably mentioned to you about we were in Mississippi somewhere. And
right.
He got on a bus and went in the place. We were coming about 4 o'clock in the morning just to get gas. And he went in the store, and people started standing up looking at him, like they wanted to. But the minute he opened his mouth, he had this very strong Caribbean, British accent. He speaks the Queen's English. And they knew he was somebody who was just completely out of place. So the ball player said, let's get out of here from Jamaica, get all his kills.
Also, your bus driver was Jim Cavan, right?
No. Jim Cobbin.
Yeah.
Jim Cobbin is a friend of mine who lives in Youngstown, Ohio. And Jim has done real well in the transportation business. He's an outfielder.
Who drove the bus?
He drove the bus part-time.
Ah.
When the chauffeur was tired, sleep, didn't get any rest, or something, for whatever reason, he would spot drive, drive the bus. But Jim is doing very well in Youngstown, Ohio, well thought of in that community.
Yeah, I mentioned about the the atmosphere. Tell me what it was like when you drove into a town and you were playing a barnstorming team.
Oh, well, we had one fellow with us that had been with us for years, a fellow by the name of Richard King. He didn't play. He was a sideshow. He acted fool, a clown on the side. And Tut, we called him. King Tut was his stage name. Knew every highway in the country. Knew where every hotel was, how to get there, turn that right in. And always we'd wake up Tut. And Tut would direct us to the hotel where we were going. And the hotel was always in a predominantly black area. So we would interact with black people, but then the next day we'd play a team that was probably predominantly white.
Reginald, hold on just a second. We're talking about the Negro Leagues with a man that experienced it as a player, second baseman with the Clowns in 1950s. That team was in Indianapolis. And we'll continue talking about that as we continue across the country and around the world with you on Sports Byline.